Headlines. Iran's leader praises the resistance of the Palestinian group the Islamic Jihad against Israel's latest airstrikes in the Gaza Strip. Urges the Palestinians to preserve unity. Syria says the U.S. is plundering its resources as data shows most of the oil produced in the country is pillaged by the illegal U.S. military presence. And Taiwan shrugs off China's one-country, two-systems model and holds a fresh live-fire drill amid simmering tensions. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Nis. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has praised the Palestinians for their resistance against Israel's latest episode of brutality. Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei hailed the Islamic Jihad movement for its, quote, courageous resistance. He said the Palestinians' resolve neutralized the occupying regime's deceptive plot and enhanced the status of resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei said the movement proved every faction of resistance can bring the enemy to its knees single-handedly. The leader also commended unity among resistance groups based in the Gaza Strip and those in the occupied West Bank. He underscored the need to maintain that unity. Ayatollah Khamenei said Israel is on the decline, while resistance is growing stronger. He reiterated Iran's support for the people of Palestine. The leader made the remarks in a response to a letter by the Islamic Jihad Secretary General. Ziad al-Nakhala hailed Iran's continued support for the Palestinians in the fight against the Israeli regime. The U.S. continues looting Syria's natural resources, as media reports reveal that American forces have recently smuggled tons of stolen Syrian oil into Iraq. Syrian media say that a convoy of over 140 tankers loaded with oil from Syrian oil fields crossed into Iraq through the illegal Al-Mahmoudiya border point in Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka. The crossing was set up by U.S. forces more than 2 years ago in the oil-rich province. Syria says American forces used the crossing to smuggle Syria's natural resources from the occupied regions into Iraq's north. U.S.-backed militant groups are in control of northern Iraq. Last week, U.S. forces and their allies reportedly sneaked a convoy of 60 vehicles, mostly tankers, loaded with Syrian oil, into Iraq via another illegal crossing. Earlier this week, a veteran Syrian politician blasted the U.S. for stealing the country's natural resources.
The United States is currently occupying Syrian territories and plundering Syria's grain and oil resources. These actions of the United States are very shameful. Hence, we never trust anything the United States says, because what they say is seriously contrary to what they do.
Shaban also condemned Washington's illegal military presence in Syria. The U.S. and militant groups it supports pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily oil production in the first half of 2022. That is according to the latest data released by the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources. Damascus considers the U.S. presence as an outright violation of its sovereignty. It has repeatedly deplored Washington for supporting armed groups and for stealing natural resources. This says U.S. smuggling has led to energy shortages in a country that used to be an oil exporter. Taiwan rejects one country, two systems model recently proposed by Beijing in a white paper amid rising tensions with a self-ruled island. Taiwan's foreign ministry spokeswoman, while reacting to the proposal, said Taiwanese people would decide the future of the island themselves. Joanne Wu accused Beijing of using the U.S. House Speaker's visit to Taipei as a pretext to, quote, intimidate Taiwanese people. The two sides are on the collision course since Nancy Pelosi's controversial visit, with each holding military drills in a show of strength. Meanwhile, Taiwan concluded its two-day maneuvers in the southern region. China also announced wrapping up its largest-ever war games around the island. China kicked off the drills after Pelosi landed in Taipei last week, despite warnings. On Wednesday, China issued yet another warning to the U.S., saying that it will fight back every provocation by Washington that undermines its sovereignty. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Western countries continue giving arms to Ukraine despite repeated warnings from Russia against the supply. Britain says it will send more multiple launch rocket systems capable of hitting targets up to 80 kilometers away. London says that it will keep up its military support. Denmark has also said it is ready for more financial assistance to Kiev. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen says half of the money goes to weapon production facilities, and the remaining half will be spent on Danish equipment and military trainings.
We need all of us to continue and to increase our support of Ukraine with weapons, training, demining, financing. I hope that we here today can agree on even more contributions. And of course, Denmark is ready to do our part. Today, we can announce a new contribution of 110 million euro for weapons, equipment and training.
Denmark's support will take its total aid to Ukraine to more than $417 million since the war began in February. Washington has already declared a $10 billion package for Ukraine. It included advanced HIMARS rocket launch systems. Moscow blames the West for prolonging the conflict through sending more arms to the battlefield. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator joining us from Moscow. We have Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, Russia has said time and again that sending more weapons to Ukraine is not going to not only solve the conflict, but it's going to prolong it. Why do you think that the U.S. and its European allies, who are NATO members, continue to sell and ship arms to Ukraine?
To prolong the conflict. I think that this is turned into a kind of existential struggle. Particularly the United States has invested heavily in the idea that this confrontation will weaken, perhaps cripple Russia, and restore the American hegemony or leadership, whatever it's called, over the Western world. And so forth. This is the course of action, and I don't think I'm saying anything controversial here. The thing that is most striking to me is that it is the material support, the arms, and moral backing that they're giving is one thing, and entirely defensible in their own terms. It is not accompanied by any diplomatic efforts or pressures whatsoever. It is just remarkable how absent, even compared to other conflicts of the past, how there's a complete vacuum of diplomatic initiative.
Marcus Papadopoulos, why do you think that vacuum exists?
Well, the Americans and, of course, NATO as a whole are attempting to exhaust the Russian army in the hope that this will suffocate the Russian economy, which would result in the Russian Federation facing a catastrophic situation whereby Russia no longer is a superpower. And what I find particularly worrying is that there are no rational or level-headed politicians in either Washington or in London or indeed Brussels, which is the home to NATO, because Russia is a nuclear superpower. It has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. The lengths to which Western policymakers are going to try and defeat the Russian army is exceedingly dangerous. But I want to say that I am of the firm opinion that Western efforts will fail. Russian military strategy, which descends from the Soviet Union, is quite distinct to that of Western military strategy. Indeed, how Russia makes war has historically baffled Western military experts. Turning to Ukraine, the Russians are waging a war of attrition against the Ukrainian armed forces, in which unit after unit, regiment after regiment, division after division of the Ukrainian army is being ground down and devoured by Russian firepower, specifically Russian artillery, which since the latter stages of the Second World War until the present day is widely recognized as the most formidable in the world. So in essence, the war in Ukraine is a war of artillery. Furthermore, in recent days, a document was leaked or appeared in the public domain, and it is claimed that it was leaked by a member of the Ukrainian High Command, in which the document stated that since the beginning of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine until the present day, the Ukrainian armed forces have incurred 191,000 losses, by which that means killed in action, wounded in action, and taken prisoner by the Russians. Now, I do not know the veracity of this document, but it is noticeable and perhaps quite telling that neither the Ukrainian government nor the Ukrainian high command nor Western mainstream media has made any mention of this document.
Well, Fred Weir, in terms of the military aspect of this whole conflict, it's not as if Ukraine has made real advancements that they can claim for it to be a success, where adding more weapons into their arsenal is going to lead to them being successful. I mean, at least in the recent months, practically. So what hope is there that the U.S. and its allies are looking to achieve by sending more military equipment to Ukraine?
I think there is a narrative that's widely believed. I know a lot of my colleagues think that Western military aid will turn the tide. It is what is being put out of Kiev, and some military experts. It doesn't really ring true to me. I sit here and I read the reports of Russian war correspondents in the Ministry of Defense, it does seem to me that they are gradually wearing down those heavily fortified regions of the Donbass. It's going very slowly. Ukrainians are fighting well. Even Russian war correspondents admit that they are showing surprising resilience. And the American weapons, particularly those HIMARS, are assisting them, that they are hitting Russian targets, ammunition dumps, and train depots and such. So the war is being prolonged. Whether the Ukrainians can muster the great counteroffensive in the south that they keep promising is one of the things that we will await in the next week or two. It doesn't look like it, but a lot of this Ukraine is winning narrative hinges upon them launching this counteroffensive and succeeding at it to retake Kherson in those southern regions. So we must just watch and see how it goes.
Final question to you, Marcus Papadopoulos. There was a report that came out. I'm pretty sure that you've heard of it, even though CBS actually has retracted that in the form of a documentary. And it was about how 70% of these arms don't actually end up in Ukrainian hands or the Ukrainian soldiers or security forces. God knows where they're going. What do you make of that report?
Well, I found it very telling how the news outlet, a few days after having published the report, then retracted it. To me, that indicates that the report, to a large extent, was accurate. After all, ever since Ukraine became an independent country in December of 1991, Ukraine has been one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Indeed, untold amounts of money has been laundered in Ukraine. And I believe that what we are seeing at present is no different. Money is being laundered in Ukraine. Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And now, but now that the Russian army is in Ukraine, there is no chance, it is simply inconceivable, that the Kremlin will allow the Russian army to be defeated. Mm-hmm. One has to understand the Russian psyche. One has to understand the Russian mindset. The Russians will go to any length to defend their motherland. So whatever the cost to the Russian army in Ukraine, the right. Kremlin and the Russian people as a whole will be prepared to make that sacrifice.
Thank you for that. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author. Thank you. And Fred Ware, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Calls are growing again for the release of Afghanistan's assets that the U.S. has frozen since the Taliban takeover of the war-torn country. Several dozen prominent American and international economists have urged Washington to hand over to Afghanistan its assets. These signatories include Nobel laureates Joseph Stiglitz and Yanis Varoufakis. In a letter to President Joe Biden and the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, they expressed concern over economic and humanitarian catastrophes unfolding in Afghanistan and blamed them on the U.S. policy. They argued Washington could not justify holding on to the reserves, warning that Afghanistan would collapse if it did not get the money back. Washington is freezing more than $9 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank. The UN and other international bodies had previously urged the U.S. government to unfreeze the assets in order to allow Afghanistan to deal with this crisis. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched a private Florida residence of Donald Trump, a dramatic and unprecedented move that prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. We have prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, FBI Raid on Trump's Residence Takes U.S. into Uncharted Territory. News that sent tremors across America broke at 6:36 p.m. local time on Monday, 8th of August, when the publisher of an obscure Florida politics website tweeted that the FBI had raided Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home, adding, with a pinch of self-deprecation, "I'm not a strong enough reporter to hunt this down, but it's real." 18 minutes later, another Florida resident responded to the news with more bombast. The former president said in an enraged statement, "These are dark times for our nation, as my beautiful home is currently under siege, raided and occupied by a large group of FBI agents." More than 30 FBI agents armed with a search warrant issued by a federal magistrate from West Palm Beach are reported to have entered Donald Trump's private residence and offices at his Mar-a-Lago club. According to NBC News, they stayed on site most of the day. Despite Trump's cries of siege and occupation, there was no unseemly bashing down of doors or igniting of loud flashbangs, for which the FBI is legendary in other situations. The search team had alerted the Secret Service agents guarding the compound in advance, ensuring an orderly execution of the search warrant. Once the operation was underway, the FBI placed a call to Eric Trump, the former president's son, who, according to the account he gave to Sean Hannity on Fox News Channel on Monday night, was the one who, in turn, broke the news to his father. At the time, father and son were in Trump Tower in Manhattan, New York, where the former president is preparing to be deposed in a civil lawsuit brought by the New York State relating to his company's financial bookkeeping. Eric Trump portrayed the search to Sean Hannity in terms as lurid as those deployed by his father. He said, "They started ransacking an office, ransacking a closet," adding, "They broke into a safe. He didn't have anything in the safe." More details will have to emerge before Eric Trump's description can be assessed for accuracy. It will also take time for a full picture to be gleaned of the FBI's reasoning behind its actions and whether that meets the exceptionally high bar needed to justify the first such raid in U.S. history on the residence of a former president. Within hours of the news erupting, Donald Trump, his family and the inner circle, and a slew of top Republicans across the country had begun assailing the Biden administration and what they called the weaponized Department of Justice for trying to thwart another presidential bid by Donald Trump in 2024. Several prominent conservatives likened the search to the actions of a tin pot dictator. Barely 18 months after the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, following Donald Trump's claims of a stolen 2020 presidential election, rampant claims by leading Republicans that the Justice Department is using its formidable powers to interfere in the 2024 presidential election could also be incendiary. On Monday night, a crowd of angry Trump supporters gathered outside the Palm Beach Club, Mar-a-Lago, in a taste of what might come. The search warrant granted to the FBI relates to official records and to the ongoing investigation into whether Donald Trump violated the Presidential Records Act. The provision requires the White House to preserve all paperwork and digital output resulting from official business and to send it for safe storage to the National Archives. The fact that the FBI sought a search warrant rather than a subpoena implies that it did not trust Donald Trump to hand over or preserve official documents in his possession. It has been known for some time that Trump has a vexed relationship with official documents. As far back as June of 2018, the website Politico was reporting that White House staff were forced to sift through large piles of shredded paper and painstakingly taped them back together. In a strange coincidence of timing, just hours before the raid began, the website Axios released photographs obtained by the New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman that appeared to show a White House toilet clogged with wads of handwritten papers. The FBI's document bust itself stems back to January, when it was revealed that after protests, Donald Trump had returned 15 boxes of documents, gifts, and letters to the National Archives. The following month, the head of the archive, David Ferrero, told Congress that the boxes included some classified national security information and that as a result of his staff had been in communication with the Department of Justice. Asher Rangappa, a former FBI special agent, pointed out that in such well-trafficked location, popular with well-connected international visitors as Mar-a-Lago, the presence of unsecured classified documents would present an ongoing national security threat that might help explain the Department of Justice's willingness to take such a dramatic and unprecedented step. The Miami Herald reported the FBI's search warrant indicated that dozens of boxes of classified materials, in addition to the 15 already returned, were thought to still be stored at Donald Trump's Palm Beach residence. According to CNN, the extra boxes had been identified in June when Department of Justice investigators traveled to Mar-a-Lago to meet with two of Donald Trump's lawyers to discuss possible classified material. At the start of the meeting, Donald Trump paid a visit and chatted to the investigators, but without answering the question. His lawyers then took the Department of Justice officials down to a basement where boxes of documents were being stored. One source told CNN that some of the documents were stamped top secret. At the heart of the detective work that will now be done on the boxes carted away from Mar-a-Lago is the question that would need to be answered before the Department of Justice launched any formal prosecution. Was Donald Trump intentionally in breach of official records laws? In the course of the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump accused Hillary Clinton to her face of acid washing or bleaching 33,000 emails. He threatened to have the Justice Department appoint a special prosecutor to look into the matter. While his rallies were regularly filled with the chant by his supporters of lock her up, lock her up. In the end, the Department of Justice decided not to prosecute Hillary Clinton because it found no evidence of intent on her part. A similar calculation is likely to be critical as investigators move forward. Under federal laws, anyone who removes classified information to an unauthorized location faces fines or imprisonment for up to 5 years, but only if they can be shown to have done so knowingly and with intent.
hidden files.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. To many, mass executions and beheadings are ancient barbaric practices that don't belong in a civilized world. Of course, we have seen Western-backed Daesh terrorists do it for the camera. But surely, it's only such heartless terrorists that commit such heinous crimes. No internationally recognized entity could possibly be guilty of mass executions. Or could it? Well, today we will travel to a corner of the world in which, in only one such instance, 81 people were executed. And yet, somehow, mainstream media has barely touched on this appalling crime and has basically hidden it from the public eye. But that's precisely the kind of file that we at Hidden Files are here to expose. So watch the next clip and follow the rest of the show, because whether or not mainstream media agrees, you have the right to know.
The 2002 mass execution was the third of its kind in 6 years. In April 2019, 37 men, mostly Shia, were beheaded in the kingdom. Also in January 2016, 47 people were executed, including prominent Shia scholar Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. But Saudi crimes also reach far and well beyond the country's borders. In 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. citizen and columnist for The Washington Post, was cut into pieces using a saw inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, which surprisingly did not have an adverse effect on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. More shocking still was how, even though the U.S. announced Saudi Arabia responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks, saying that nearly all of those involved were trained in Saudi Arabia, the U.S.-Saudi relationship remained intact. Syed Hamza al-Shakuri from Awamiya is a founder and member of the Khalas movement, formed in 2004. The Khalas movement is a dissident group with members inside Saudi Arabia, as well as in many countries around the world. The members are both young and old and from different Islamic schools of thought, but they all share a single goal: to raise awareness about and stop the oppression of people inside Saudi Arabia. Mr. al-Shakuri had to flee Saudi Arabia and is now a vocal dissident in New Zealand.
Thank you so much. I'd like to welcome Mr. al-Shakuri to the program. A pleasure having you with us. Can you tell us about the latest mass execution that took place in Saudi Arabia?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I am here with you because I am a dissident of the Saudi regime and representative of my community, which are oppressed in the Arabian Peninsula and Hejaz. In this country, nobody is able to express his ideas freely on what is happening to him. So we're forced to leave the country and live in exile and be away from the pressure of the Saudi persecution, so we can show the injustice of our community and to express its suffering and expose the oppression which they are being subjected to. Whether it's in Al-Qatif and Al-Ahsa, or in Mecca and Medina or Hijaz, or even in the Najd and Asir, even if we've fled our ancestral homes in Al-Qatif, we carry the concern of the entire population of the Arabian Peninsula and Hejaz.
When the Saudi regime says that the 81 people that were executed that day were all terrorists, I mean, what do you say to that? What do you have to say?
The big massacre in the month of Shaban, the Saudi regime executed 81 people, among them 41 Shia, and among those were children. The trial did not even conclude for the majority of these people. What occurred was a swift operation in the final moments in order to present this number and behead them with a sword in an ugly, bloody, barbaric massacre of Shias and Sunnis from different regions in Saudi Arabia. Among them was my younger brother, Muhammad al-Shakuri, my cousin, Syed Asad Maki al-Sayed Shabar al-Sayed Ali, and among them was a large amount from al-Awamiya, from which they executed 28 martyrs who were beheaded on that day. These people, many of their family until today, do not know precisely. We say they were beheaded, but we do not know in a certain and definitive manner what happened. It is possible they were killed via other methods. It is possible bullets were fired at them or they were buried alive. The Saudi government does not disclose or announce anything, the timing, place, or how the execution was carried out. All of this information we do not know. Our families received reports of the execution from the TV, newspapers, social media, Twitter, Facebook, and such like. Even the families who visited their sons a week before the execution. The martyr that was executed did not know this would be his final meeting, nor did the family of the martyr know that this would be the last moment they would see their son.
Well, I mean, how likely is it possible that some of them are guilty of terrorism charges?
Firstly, I will start with a quick point. The Saudi regime terror does not need any evidence. The Saudis export terrorism across the globe. Who established Daesh with the cooperation of American intelligence? Who sent explosives and suicide bombers to Iraq? Who sent and backed suicide bombers to fight alongside Daesh and the Nusra Front in Syria? Is there anyone else that funded them apart from the Saudis with American and Western intelligence? Who kidnapped, killed, and dismembered Khashoggi inside the consulate? How did they cut him to pieces? They declared that Khashoggi departed the consulate. And only after the Turks exposed the atrocity with photos and videos was the Saudi regime forced to acknowledge, but they still tried to avoid complicity by saying those were rogue agents. The bloody, barbaric exportation of Saudi crimes has reached India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and even Iran. They didn't leave one region alone. Who committed the 9/11 attacks? Was it not the Saudis? Saudi terrorism is so clear that it doesn't need discussion or providing evidence about it. It's occurring in front of our eyes. It's occurring in front of the eyes of the world and is happening outside the perimeters and territories of the Arabian Peninsula and Hejaz. So, what does this say about what is happening inside the Saudi mortal, and I don't say Saudi kingdom? So we, our people and family who are inside, we're under the authority of an oppressive terrorist regime. Of course it's going to accuse us of going above the law and similar accusations. Those who were executed, the majority of them were protesters. Civilians who came out for peaceful protests, demanding their rights, equality, democracy, freedom, free elections, fairness, and justice in the distribution of the national resources. They are demanding services and their right to employment, housing, education, and medical care. This is why they took to the streets. These are not terrorists. Yes, maybe we don't know all 81 were executed, but we are sure of the 41 who are our family from Al-Ghatif. Those I know personally and closely. But let's say, for example, that among the 81, there were a limited number of 3, 4, maybe less, maybe more, that are affiliated with Daesh, for example, or to Al-Qaeda. Was it the sin of the rest? And those affiliated with Daesh or Al-Qaeda, do they not have the right to a fair trial? Do they not have the right to a transparent and open trial? Do they not have the right to appoint an attorney and appear on the TV screens, for example, and the trials are conducted in a transparent and public way? And then, whoever is proven against him that he engaged in terror or killing or such, that person is prosecuted within a legal framework. But you gather 81 people and label them all as terrorists, as killers or practiced violence. This is a kangaroo court. We cannot accept that.
Well, you're talking about major human rights violations. Did any human rights organization get involved? Have they been aggressive in following this up?
To answer this question, allow me to clarify a little and make it clear, because the matters are intertwined and there are several dimensions. The first issue is that there are activists, advocates, both in Europe and America. They sympathize with us. They have a sense of humanity and a clear conscience. Most of them are sincere, speaking generally. We trust their sympathy, solidarity, and humanity. However, as people and individuals, their position does not influence national policy. When it comes to Western governments, the Western political system, even international human rights organizations, they are affiliated to a Western agenda. They're affiliated to the agenda of American and Western intelligence. The West stops with just condemnation. They only sell us talk without any action. These condemnations are fruitless. Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi authorities will not be able to carry out such crimes and continue committing terror if it was not for the backing and support of the West and its governments. Mohammed bin Salman is simply an official of the West. He is being used as a puppet. The West, in particular America, if they wanted to even replace King Salman and his son from the throne of the kingdom, they can do that. So the Arab governments, and especially the Persian Gulf sheikhdoms, generally are puppets in implementing the agenda of the West. The West stops with just talk, condemnations, and declarations. This does not change anything. What we are demanding is a true stance and active stances. Over the past 5 years, the Saudi regime has committed 3 barbaric massacres. In the first massacre, it executed Ayatollah Sheikh al-Nimr, along with 46 other people. And then it executed 37 people, among them Sheikh Mohammed al-Atiyah and others. Now we have another massacre with 81 victims. And the Khashoggi crime case is still not settled. What has the West done in the face of these crimes? What is the West doing today against the Saudi regime over its crimes in Yemen, for example? The starvation of millions of Yemenis as a result of the blockade it imposes on the Yemeni nation. What has the West done as Saudis kill thousands in Yemen? Who arms Saudi Arabia and signs weapons contracts with them? Is it not America and the Western countries? The reality is, Western governments view our regions only as storage facilities for their energy, the oil and the gas. This is what the West is gambling on. They do not care about values, equality, human rights, or the life of our people, nor the sanctity of their blood.
How can a country execute 81 men on the same day and not be condemned by countries which say that protecting human lives and human rights are some of their main responsibilities in the world? Let's look at some of the reactions from some countries and entities when it became known that the Saudi regime had murdered 81 people in one day. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet voiced her concern over the extremely broad definition of terrorism in Saudi legislation, which led to holding unfair trials and executions of dozens of dissidents in the Saudi kingdom. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price, in a briefing, did not condemn Saudi allies for the mass executions. He only spoke of fair trial guarantees in the Saudi kingdom. The EU stated it remains concerned about the continued use of capital punishment in Saudi Arabia and will continue to raise its position with the Saudis. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson visited Saudi Arabia within a week of the executions, not to condemn Riyadh for the killings, but to try to get Saudi Arabia to pump more oil. These reactions should come as no surprise. If we rewind back to October of 2018, we will recall the heinous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. He was killed and sawed into pieces inside of the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was a journalist and Washington Post columnist, a Saudi dissident and an American permanent resident. There was a lot of noise made about his murder, just because of the shocking way it took place and that Khashoggi's fiance was waiting outside for him to come out of the consulate. But Saudi Arabia never faced any ramifications for murdering this American resident. In February of 2021, U.S. intelligence agencies reported that the Saudi de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, approved the assassination of Khashoggi. Despite all of this, recently bin Salman got the red carpet treatment in France and from its president, Emmanuel Macron. And U.S. President Joe Biden actually flew to Saudi Arabia to meet with MBS. So what expectations can the world really have of these countries caring about and holding the regime responsible for the execution of 81 Saudi and Yemeni nationals? The reality is that oil rules. Petrol is prioritized over people and profit over justice for these governments. The only justice for the regime's crimes will come at the hands of its own people and not anyone else.
Do you think your country will change?
Saudi crimes are old and committed as they began occupying these regions. And all this occurred at the time under the guise of the British. The English were present to create this artificial entity. As for will it change? Yes, it will change. We are faithful that we are capable of implementing this change. However, this needs time, work, and activity. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, says, strive to pass honor to your children. Today, we must work to plant the seeds. We must tire ourselves. We must sacrifice whatever we can, no matter how much we suffer and sacrifice, so that our children are able to live freely, to enjoy their pride and honor. But if we sit back and watch on without debating, speaking out, taking any action, without struggling, then Al Saud will remain in power. Yes, this rule will pass away. The monarchy of Al Saud will pass away, and we have real experience today. How is Ansarullah, the Yemeni people, the army and popular committees facing a global war and blockade imposed on them, despite such little capabilities? They did not flee from their coalition, which includes firstly the Americans, the Zionists, the West, and then the Emiratis and the Saudis. This defenseless people managed to gain experience, power, and counterattack the enemy's war that is being launched by the Saudi coalition. We also have capabilities too in our region, and there are 2 million Shia Muslims only in Al-Ghatif and Al-Aqsa who are being hurt by this regime. Our brothers in Hijaz, our brothers in Asir, today there is an opposition from different religious sects and different regions. and we are in cooperation and coordination, and we are confident in God.
Now, you may wonder how, despite all of this, the regime remains a close U.S. ally and enjoys impunity from sanctions and other preventative measures. And just a few years ago, was even appointed the head to a key United Nations human rights panel. Well, the answer lies in what inspired former U.S. President Donald Trump to call the Saudi regime the milk cow of the U.S. Let's take a look at this.
U.S. administrations have long allied themselves with Saudi Arabia, and the Trump administration is no exception. But in view of continued human rights abuses by the Saudis, including the murder and dismemberment of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, I asked the president why he's overruled Congress to allow more arms sales to Saudi Arabia. His answer boiled down in a word, money.
They buy massive amounts, $150 billion worth of military equipment that, by the way, we use their military equipment. And unlike other countries that don't have money, and we have to subsidize everything, so Saudi Arabia is a big buyer of America product. That means something to me. It's a big producer of jobs.
Of course, the Saudi regime has made clear efforts to change its public image into a more progressive one, such as loosening the country's tight restrictions on drinking, gambling, and concerts. But to those who are fighting for their rights inside, the kingdom will remain a land of silencing people's voices and eliminating opposition through mass executions. Yet the human cost will remain overlooked by mainstream media so long as major powers can continue to milk this cow. So it's up to us to stay alert and active and to enhance the voices of those less heard. For many of you out there, today's story was a personal account, but the story of many more remains untold, and that's what we're here for. So contact us and share your story and stay with us for the journey, as next week we will be zooming in on somewhere else that corporate media is trying to ignore. Thanks so much for being with us right here at Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Until next time, stay inquisitive.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.